Hi, I'm Ari Melber from The Nation magazine, here with Perry Bacon from The Washington Post. We first met back a few years ago at Yearly Coasts and traveled together at times on the Barack Obama campaign plane in 2008. How are you, Perry?
I'm great. It's good to see you again, Ari.
Nice to see you. So we'll dive into it. You were going to tell us a little bit about an upcoming milestone for President Obama.
In a few weeks, April 30th will be 100 days for the new president. And I guess I wanted to talk to you about first, what do you think about how he's doing? How is he doing in the first 100 days? I know you saw some things he likes and that you've liked that he's done. You saw some things he hasn't done that you think he should do, and some things he's done that you haven't liked. So talk about that a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key things happening here is a sorting out of where he is delivering on promises and where he is not. And that's obviously not the only frame, but it's an important one. And I think on foreign policy, on reaching out to the Middle East, on loosening aspects of the embargo against Cuba, he is doing well. And on the budget, he's got a progressive budget with a lot of spending, which you may like or dislike, but it is the kind of progressive change he said he would bring to Washington. In the financial sector, it's a mixed bag, but I think that there's a lot of sympathy for what the administration's going through. Then, as you move out to transparency and rule of law accountability issues, surveillance, torture, the state secrets privilege, which is finally getting some much-needed attention, we're seeing not only, I think, disappointment in a real refusal to advance government accountability, whether it's for past actions under the previous administration or ongoing issues, say for surveillance, which is very much a looking forward issue. We're seeing that, and we're seeing him really contradict things he said in the campaign. On surveillance, he said he was going to fight immunity. He was going to look for accountability and measures in the courts to make sure that everyone got to the bottom of allegations of illegal surveillance, and now he's doing the opposite in several cases. So that's what I'm seeing. What are you seeing?
What I'm seeing is, I mean, I generally think he's doing most, let me say two things first that he has not done that he talked about. I think one of them we could argue was probably a silly campaign promise, or I would say at least was he said he was going to make sure he didn't hire any lobbyists in his anybody who lobbied the government recently would go into his administration. I think that was, in some ways, I mean, he sort of demonized lobbyists in a way. I mean, lobbyists are protected in the First Amendment on some level. I thought that, I mean, being a lobbyist for the National Education Association is not a bad thing. It's not that lobbyists are bad, it's that, I mean, the critique usually is that members of Congress are too beholden to them, but that is usually more of a problem of members of Congress than someone being a lobbyist themselves. I mean, in general, what he's done has been what we expected in terms of the economy and domestic policy. I think you're right, he's done largely what I thought. I mean, one of the big debates in Washington has been, and I know you have some strong views about this too, is that, you know, is he being bipartisan enough, and what does that mean? I think that, you know, I think his staff would probably say now, looking back, that they spent too much time during the stimulus debate trying to, you know, they allowed too much focus to get about how many Republicans voted for the stimulus. I mean, I think that Obama did want to communicate that he is listening to the Republicans, he wants to hear what they say. I'm not sure they wanted the obsession about how many House Republicans voted for the stimulus, which turned out to be, you know, a zero number, which was, you know, was not totally shocking, I don't think.
Well, to jump in there, Perry, I mean, I think bipartisanship only works when you have good faith partners who actually want to do something together. Republicans, from teabagging to the rank and file opposition to the budget and any kind of working together, show that they're just not in that place right now. I guess one question is, I mean, do you think at this point the Washington media culture has sort of gotten over bipartisanship? Because a lot of people feel like this is something that is only valuable in D.C., that if you go out, especially in this economic crisis, and ask people, they just don't care whether you had 61 or 67 votes on cloture, right? I mean, do you think that this D.C. obsession is finally starting to fade as well?
I don't think so, actually. I sort of think, like I said, Obama put a lot of emphasis on himself at the beginning to some extent. I think that Obama's campaign, however you define it, talked about changing the tone in Washington, and I'm not sure how you define the tone in Washington, but I do think that because of the way he, you know, people felt like he brought the country together, or his campaign talked about it a lot, there's going to be a Washington obsession with how many people vote for the budget, how many Republicans ultimately vote for the budget, how many Republicans vote for the health care bill, if they jam a health care bill through without any Republican votes. You're going to see a lot of this is sort of how Washington works, and I think Republicans Republicans will get attention for that. Do people in the country care? I think particularly right now, like you said, with the economic crisis going on, I think the answer is probably no in a lot of ways, that they don't, they are not really concerned about the sort of, you know, how many House Republicans voted for a budget. You know, I think people know Democrats are in charge, and they're sort of, and if you're Obama in 4 years, what you're looking at is people are going to judge you based on, did you get health care done? Did you improve the economy? Not did John Boehner like you or not? Or did you guys, you know, smile at each other at some dinner?
And so, you know, that's funny. So you say you don't think it's ending in terms of the media obsession. You saw that in, I think, the daily briefings at the White House, where there's a lot of questions about what the Republicans are up to, kind of as its own topic. You know, there's also, of course, this sort of pirate mania we just had and puppy dog mania, again, in a sharp contrast to what I think most people care about when they're looking at what government's doing during this crisis. Do you think that the media is doing a decent job covering Obama?
Let me disagree with you slightly and say that didn't everyone you know talk about the dog and Michelle Obama's arms? I'm so tired of hearing about Michelle Obama's arms and her dresses.
No, only I don't have coffee with David Brooks, and he's the only one I know who's obsessed with Michelle Obama's arms.
I'm gonna tell you, I went to a class. A friend of mine teaches at the University of Maryland, a journalism class, and she had me there come to talk about, you know, what my job is and that kind of thing. So I told the students about, you know, and then at some point I asked the students, you know, so what do you all think of the media? And one of the students criticized the media for covering silly things like what Michelle Obama was wearing all the time. And then I asked about the foreign trip, and a student right in front of her talking about, well, Michelle Obama was really covered well, and she really was wearing a great, you know, great dresses, and she was so well dressed. And so I asked the student, what do you think about the budget process, how that was covered? And she said, you mean the budget for the clothing? And then she started talking about how much the clothing cost and that kind of thing, how much she guessed the dresses cost, that kind of thing. I genuinely think that, you know, I understand a lot of the media criticism. I think it's well intentioned, but you know, the voters get the kind of media they're asking for often. I mean, I guarantee you there's a lot of interest in what Michelle Obama's doing, what she's wearing. I mean, these networks, the networks particularly know what, you know, what sells on some level. And I think that the arcane details of reconciliation are not exactly going to, you know, make increase the ratings a lot. I think that,
so,
you know,
basically what you're saying, Perry, is we need pirates to go to Afghanistan if we're ever going to get decent coverage of what's happening.
No. I'm going to defend my colleagues and say we are getting decent coverage that way. I think there has been coverage of the stimulus money. I think the Washington Post, to talk about my own newspaper, has done a lot of coverage about what the stimulus money is doing and what it isn't doing. There's been good coverage, but are you going to see some amount of... The Obamas have become like cultural... I mean, don't you agree with this? The Obamas have become cultural icons of sort, and that's going to affect how they're covered. I think they're being covered in a way beyond... They're the first black family in the White House, so we got a lot of things that are going to be covered about them sort of beyond the substance, and I think that's true. Let me ask you a question, though. Here's one of the things I'm worried about is that I find increasingly people who I think are very intelligent people and very thoughtful in a lot of ways seem like, you know, as the Obama administration is in office, they only, you know, people are already in their little camps already, you know, where increasingly because of the new media, people I know only read the Huffington Post and watch Jon Stewart and watch Stephen Colbert, or they only listen to Rush Limbaugh and read National Review, I'm not just saying this because I want the Washington Post circulation to go up. I really think that it's important to read objective sources of news, and I worry that the new media is creating a media in which you can like sort of spend all your time on your side.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old debate, but it's very much alive right now. I don't think it is as stark as people say. I mean, there's a lot of scholarship on this. Cass Sunstein, when he was at University of Chicago in Republic.com, talked about this, and other scholars talk about a cyber balkanization. Sunstein now, of course, is inside the Obama administration. But others, James Walcott and others, have responded to that and actually looked at a lot of data that suggests that high information users who go to more than one news source, more than one website, do tend to get a range of views. If you are relying on one, old media or new, it could be only Rush Limbaugh, only one newspaper, or only the Huffington Post, then sure, that's already a form of self-selection. But what we're seeing also, I think, is a bifurcation where there's a larger class of information consumers and activists who tend to read a lot. I know a lot of liberals who read the Drudge Report, and I know a lot of conservatives who at least keep an eye on Huffington Post, maybe not with the same depth that they would read something they're more likely to agree with, but because it matters. And a lot of liberals spend a lot of time talking about Fox News. You can have a separate debate over the media bashing, etc. But again, it shows an awareness of what the other side may be saying. So it doesn't seem to me that that's the only game in town is sort of only drilling down. I do think, if you're only listening to Rush or you're only reading one website, then yeah, you've got a poverty of views. But I think this is overstated, and I often wonder, and to flip the question back to you, I mean, is part of this also that we need newspapers? I wouldn't say that what's happening on the web can replace local and strong investigative journalism, but isn't there this extra kind of newsroom culture of bashing the web and bashing what's new because people are upset about what are obviously terrible changes in the industry?
I don't think so. I mean, we could get into a longer discussion about this, but I mean, I think a lot of people in the newsroom are using Twitter, and I know a lot of us use Facebook to find sources for stories, and it's expanded our universe a lot too. I mean, I think some of these sites are very useful. I read Talking Points Memo, I read the Drudge Report, I read all these things every day. I do think that there becomes a little bit of obsession with, you know, we get sort of stuck on, I occasionally Matt Drudge becomes my assignment editor, I worry, just because we're so focused on making sure we're catching up with all the little tidbits of the day. We sort of miss the bigger picture, but that's a problem we should deal with. You know, in, as far as a media organization, we have to figure out, you know, what matters to us as far as our stories and what's important, and so on. To come back,
well,
to
that's Hunter, a, I'll, you know, let me. I'll jump in on that just briefly to say that's always an interesting piece. When we were on the Obama plane, I always noticed there was a whole slew of reporters that would flip open their laptops and they had their own media website, obviously, and then they would have Drudge or Huffington Post, and then there were some other reporters, and myself included, that would look more to, my first read would be Memorandum, because it pulls from all over the web. You're talking about diversity. It's got, I'm looking
That's
at
true.
50 links, I'm looking
right.
at who's
right.
linking to what,
right.
as an aggregator, or Google News, although not as good, does that. And that seems to be another real cultural break, is do you rely on Matt Drudge and Arianna Huffington to be your tip sheet, or do you do more of a larger crowdsourcing model? I don't know if you, I mean, you're a relatively young reporter like myself, I don't know which camp you'd be in, actually.
You know, I have to confess, I'm more in the Matt Drudge camp, if only because inevitably my competitors are reading those kind of things. I try to do both. I mean, I have a lot of Google alerts about all kinds of things that I read, you know, the kinds of things I write about, from Michael Steele, the RNC chair, to various House members I'm covering, or that kind of thing. But I do, you know, read those. There's a one on Time Magazine called The Page that I remember during the campaign we all checked obsessively, if only because we knew. I have to be on top of, like, which obscure congressman from which state is endorsing Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. I mean, there is some culture from the campaign.
And Mark Halperin always had your back, huh?
Or just led that coverage a lot. So in that sense, I did have to be, I mean, plugged in on that. I mean, again, I would on the larger issue of the media change, I would say this: people have more sources of information than ever to read, and I think that's great, particularly about national politics. You can get a perspective about every part of national politics more than you ever could, and more as a more diversity of views out there, which, you know, I think goes to this conversation we're having. Then, I mean, I don't think it's no longer the Times, the Post, and your network news. It's like a lot of different blogs and a lot of different voices have a role in politics, and I think that's great.
Yeah, and I mean, one more point on that. The Project for Excellence in Journalism does these roundups, and in the most recent report, they showed that the share of newspapers that now link to other media and other sources of information has skyrocketed, and it used to be the minority. In other words, most major papers would avoid linking. And basically, in a short number of years now, it's the majority. And that is a complete reorientation. It sounds like a small thing, maybe, but it's actually a complete reorientation of whether you define your site as a destination, which was the old model,
right,
or as a gateway, as a portal. And I see that in Washington Post with live chats and interactivity, and also a lot of links to what blogs are saying, I think has definitely taken up that mantle, and I think it's good. I don't know if it's great for traffic every day, but it's definitely good for journalism.
All right, let me track back a second. We were talking about the 100 days, and we got up to the media. Let me ask about 100 days again. If George Bush had announced that 17,000 troops were moving to a foreign country to a war that a lot of people don't believe should be continued, I think he would have got a lot of criticism. What's going on that, I mean, I know Barbara Lee is his congressman from head of the Congressional Black Caucus, a very anti-war congresswoman from California, who essentially, you know, put out a press release saying she opposed the sort of increase in troops in Afghanistan, but it's really not done a whole lot at all. I mean, I know you've been critical of Obama in certain areas, but I'm not hearing a lot of, it seems as if he's taking positions that people on the left disagree with, and they're sort of silently they're not doing a lot about it. What do you think about that?
I think that's the biggest story that's not being told right now, is that largely because there's so few aggressive Democratic voices in Congress on a range of issues, and those that are aggressive, for whatever reasons we can get into, often are not given the media spotlight, so they're not treated as front page oppositional stories in the way that certain members are. Evan Bayh gets a lot of attention for whether he's not going to support the budget or what have you.
Ari, I'm going to cut you off briefly. Don't you think if Senator Leahy had demanded a truth commission and told Barack Obama he would demand it every day until the end of this administration, that he would have gotten more attention rather than it appear that he had a hearing, nothing happened, and he seems to have not done anything about it since then? I mean, couldn't he have demanded? I mean, he would have got a lot of attention if he had demanded. The truth commission, of course, is one, the idea to sort of look into past abuses in the Bush administration that a lot of liberals are for, and Obama has sort of signaled he's not for. I mean, couldn't that have drawn a lot of attention if Leahy had sort of, or other senators that really pushed that?
I do agree with that, and I do think that Senator Leahy has been more of a profile in procrastination in holding these hearings and talking about these issues a lot, but he hasn't even introduced text for a bill on this commission of inquiry or truth commission, let alone gotten the real backing together, which is his job as a senator. If he actually believes in it, the first thing you do is drop the bill. And I do think, though, if you look at the Senate, there aren't a lot of senators, perhaps I'm working out an answer to the original question, there aren't a lot of senators that are choosing to use their bully pulpits to really go at Obama on Middle East policy right now in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think it does reflect this sort of honeymoon period on a range of issues. Now, you mentioned torture. I do think Glenn Greenwald and some other writers are starting to coalesce around a very obvious, glaring set of broken promises on state secrets, torture, and accountability, which I mentioned. And I think we're going to continue to see that. We'll put a link up to an interesting Josh Gerstein article in Politico this week. I don't agree with all of the framing, but he definitely runs through a lot of the arguments, although he argued it as sort of legal left criticizing Obama. It's really sort of the mainstream and the center of the legal establishment on those issues that I mentioned. But I guess it comes back to this honeymoon period, you know, put the media aside and just say, yeah, it doesn't seem like the majority of Democrats are going to bat against Obama for now because of the honeymoon, or maybe, I don't know if your reporting on the Hill is finding because of some other reason.
I think that one is the honeymoon period. Two, like if you're, like I mentioned, Barbara Lee, who's a African-American congressman, Barack Obama is so popular among African-American voters, I think it would be almost bad politics for you to, you know, attack him unless you really had some strong reason to. I think he's in a honeymoon period. He's very popular among the Democratic base right now, and this is where a lot of these members are from. And three, he hasn't done anything. I mean, in the campaign, he more or less laid out that he was going to make Afghanistan the war of the future and Iraq was the past. So, I mean, I think that he also hasn't taken any. If you remember the whole Rick Warren thing back when he invited this Rick Warren, a pastor who's against gay marriage, he invited him to do the invocation of the inauguration. There was criticism of that. So it's not as if Obama has not taken any criticism. So I would say that.
So not to put you on the spot, but on Iraq, do you think there is some date, some upcoming turning point where we're going to see the rubber hit the road if people don't feel he's pulled out enough troops or made the right moves? I mean, how much time does he get?
You know, I don't have a good sense of that. I just don't. I mean, we've seen so little. You know, they left more troops there. I mean, I remember Speaker Pelosi on the day that was announced sort of raised some issue about do we need 50,000 troops? I think that's the number. Do we need that number of troops? And they haven't really. But I'm not sure. I mean, I think it might require. I mean, I hate to talk about this frame it this way, but it might depend on the situation there. If there are more deaths there, that kind of thing. I don't know when the. I mean, there was some point in 2006 where I thought the war is sort of the public opinion is shot down, and you know there was like an immediate demand almost for a reduction of troops, which didn't happen, but the Democrats did win the election, which I think was related to that situation. So,
right.
It's interesting.
All right.
To watch.
Well, Perry, I'm going to take the initiative here for a new topic. You can't see me, although people at home can. I'm doing a too legit to quit sign into the video. Can you guess what the next topic is?
I can't. So go ahead.
You can't?
I cannot.
Too legit to quit is an outdated rap reference that no one who is cool or current or with it would ever make. And that must remind you of our friend Michael Steele, who, although he's pulled back a little bit on the cool mode, he continues to make waves. And why don't you talk a little bit about the story you did on him, and then I'll tell you why I think he is such a gift to the Democratic Party.
You know, I did a piece about him right as he was in the midst of the Rush Limbaugh controversy, which essentially, and in that day, essentially, even in that controversy, he said, "I'm here to like make noise." I don't know what the quote exactly is. I'm trying to remember, but he made a comment about, "I'm here to make noise." From the beginning, I mean, when he first won that chairmanship, he had a big press conference and was very excited and said, "You know, I'm ready to take Barack Obama on." He's been that's his style. His style is a little bit flamboyant. I'm just not sure Republicans are really looking for. I mean, the Republicans I talk to is not that they think that they wanted to get a new kind of face for their part of the party. They wanted more diversity. That was something they were curious they wanted. But I think they would like him to go behind the scenes, raise money, help them build a re-party infrastructure, and sort of get away from the camera. But he seems, I mean, almost unable to do that. He said last week in Florida, you know, he wanted to make sure more delegates, there was a more diverse slate of delegates to the Republican convention next year, and his phrase he used was, "Please help a brother out." I'm not sure that's what Republican voters are looking for. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm all for helping a brother out. I just don't think he has found his rhythm, and we're way past the time where he should have settled in. And it really speaks to the larger vacuum in the Republican Party. There was a new piece out by J. Newton Small in Time Magazine just in the middle of this week, talking about how this really is a party without a message and without leadership. And the Democratic National Committee has been seizing on this, making fun of the whole attempt to have a party of new ideas on the Republican official website, which then, of course, just led back to old speeches. It's like a self-parody, right? They say they're going to have new ideas, and it's literally, provably, demonstrably old stuff.
All right, let me interrupt you a second.
Go ahead. Thing.
Weren't people saying this in 2005, you know, the Democrats can't win anything, they're going to be I read a story today about the permanent Democratic majority. Remember the permanent Republican majority in 2005? There were several books written on the subject.
Are you talking about, was it a Tom Edsel story?
I believe that Tom Edsel, I don't want to ridicule one of my fellow journalists, but I believe that he wrote a book.
But I think I saw that headline from Tom Edsel, and I'm pretty sure he wrote that about the Republican Party.
So,
I agree, and I'm not, you'll notice, I'm not, just to jump in again, I'm not saying anything about the long-term outcome here, but I am pointing out that long past the time where this party should have regrouped and figured out what it wanted to say to Barack Obama.
Well, they have figured that out. I think they have figured it out.
Tell me what it is.
Barack Obama is going to spend a lot of money to improve the government, and they think that he's spending too much money. I mean, they've been very clear about, you know, they feel like they lost the party of fiscal responsibility sort of notion, and they're really pushing back to get that again. I think they've been very clear on that point. I mean, in terms of like new leadership, yes, Sarah Palin has had
well,
a
let
bad
me,
few
I'm
months.
Well, I'm going to jump. I have to jump in again because I do disagree with you. I think that that's one message.
Yeah,
there's another message. But there's another message from Michael Steele that is about inclusion, that is about party building. It is sort of a poor man's Howard Dean in the sense that he's talking about building up this party. But that's a very different message politically than a policy critique. And there's a third message from our teabagging friends who are talking about taxes in a way that, say, Ben Stein, who's a very prominent Republican and a writer, he said in the New York Times this weekend, it's just false. The premise of the teabag protests, whatever else you want to say, is false in that there is not a giant tax increase looming here on any large segment of the population, which is different from campaign arguments you might make where you claim that's going to happen. Now you have a Congress and a president, and you don't have the kind of tax increases they're claiming, leaving aside the historical problems with the Tea Parties that Fox News and the Republicans are promoting. So I would say right there we have three different messages.
I don't think those are in contradiction. I think that the Republicans in the Congress would always warn about tax increases. Maybe I don't think they would agree with all the rhetoric of the Tea Parties, but they generally, I mean, the Tea Parties I don't think necessarily are so reflective of the leadership. I think that Michael Steele would tell you we can be the anti-tax, anti-government party, but still expand it to minorities and expand it to women and expand it to other people. I don't know if that's going to work or not, but I think they would say someone of the Democrats. The Democrats did not change their views at all in 2006, but gained a lot of seats, and they gained a lot of seats because President Bush more or less, you know, was viewed
but
as...
But why should, yeah. I mean, not to overgeneralize, but why should, say, urban minority voters favor less government spending?
because they think it's increasing the deficit. Because they, I mean, for all the reasons that white voters feel this way, I mean, there's a certain segment of the population. I mean, John McCain won 47% of the vote. I think that, I mean, they would try to. First of all, I don't think Michael Steele really thinks they're going to win huge numbers of the black. I mean, maybe. Well, Michael Steele actually told me he does. I'm just not sure that's any other Republican thinks they're going to win huge numbers of the black vote right now. I do.
And
think
let's pause there. Let's pause there, though. When he says that he does. And you talk to him, can you get numbers out of him? I mean, what happens at that moment in the interview when he says something that you think is just very unlikely?
I mean, his point, which I think is probably a good one, is, you know, we will never know until we try. And we're not trying that. We have been. His critique is the Republican Party has been trying that hard yet, and they should just try harder and see what happens. I think that what you'll probably end up seeing is more. I mean, he'll speak in front of African American audiences for sure. There's a governor's race in New Jersey and in Virginia this year. If you see a lot of Republican money spent to turn out voters in Newark, then you'll really get a sense of what their strategy. I mean, ultimately, the money will show you what they think they can really do. But it's an interesting play. I think most Republicans would say they lost the election because, black voters never vote for Republican, but I think that they lost Hispanics, they lost white women, they lost suburban voters. These are groups that, in theory, they can get back if like they say. Again, I think 2010 and 2012 are all about the economy and Barack Obama, and those things are not totally related, but they're going to be related in voters' minds, is my guess.
Well, you know, the segment they lost the most was voters under 30. They lost by 34 points.
Yes.
Whereas the George Bush 2004 campaign only lost that same cohort by 7 points. So that's where you actually had one of the largest shifts. And it's an open question. I don't think that those 20-somethings are going to automatically be Democrat to the tune of a 30-plus point margin automatically at all. But I do think those are voters that have a great deal of esteem and enthusiasm for Barack Obama. Right. And the message they're hearing in all three of the arguments that I mentioned from the Republicans are about building up Republicans and criticizing economic policy in often tangential ways. None of that really speaks to, I think, the core excitement and energy and enthusiasm that grew up around the Obama campaign. And I don't think that means the Republicans could never speak to it, but they'd have to speak to it in a more respectful and serious way. And I haven't seen that messaging or that appeal at all.
Let me say that I think that we've got a lot of stages to go here before ultimately the person who decide how Republicans do among the youth vote is probably the candidate in 2012, who we don't know yet, and I would say we don't have probably a good sense of yet. So I think we should wait for that. But right now, the Republicans I talk to say that right now their problem is that even their base wasn't even excited about them early on. So I think what you're seeing now is they were worried early on their base. You know, I think Obama's disapproval rating, his approval was 60%, which is high, but the other problem for them was his disapproval was only 15 or 20, meaning a lot of Republicans who voted against him were still saying, he's okay. I think that by making it a sort of a divisive big government, small government fight, they have sort of rallied their own base. And the first thing you want to do if you're trying to, like, you know, rebuild your party is on some level make sure you have your base and then try to expand it to others.
The first thing you want to do is have a tea party. Everyone knows after you lose an election, you have a tea party. And so there's no arguing about that. Well, to keep it moving, our next topic is about one of the only state that has both one governor and one senator, although that seems to be changing. What's your take here on Minnesota and how the Hill is responding to something that's very much a Hill story as well as a Minnesota story, the fact that the Democrats never seem to be able to seat someone who seemed to win the election?
What we're seeing, I think, is that Al Franken, of course, against Norm Coleman. Norm Coleman won't concede, but I think that Norm Coleman is starting an appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. And you are, and this might take another month or so, and this has been a long process, but I don't see a lot of Republicans who are saying Norm Coleman's talked about, if he loses this, taking it to federal court. I don't think you're seeing the enthusiasm among other Republicans, particularly the governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, about seeing him keep appealing this. I think he may be entering his last avenue. It's been a long time, I can see, but I think he may be entering his last avenue. Let me turn a question to you, though. Is Al Franken going to be a good senator, you think? And tell me why you think he'd be a good senator. Is he going to be an impact player in the Senate?
Well, there's good, of course, can be many things. Number one, is he going to be an effective senator? Is he going to be better than the average freshman senator? Probably yes, in delivering for his state, because he, like Obama, like Hillary Clinton, like other people who we've seen really instantly use their Senate position for national platform positions. He has that national name ID. He is a true celebrity. I'm not commenting, of course, on whether it's good that our politics works like this. It's a separate discussion.
Right.
But this is a guy who got booked on The Tonight Show. Okay, this is a guy who has the kind of celebrity that a lot of professional entertainers try to build over an entire career. He achieved
right.
that at a relatively young age, moved into politics and radio, became a senator, and so he really brings a different portfolio and a real different impact ability than your average senator. So if we mean good, effective, able to get more attention than most freshmen would and use the national platform and have a sort of an outside-in strategy, then yes. I mean, when I worked for Senator Cantwell, what we had, of course, was senators who had all of those things and then, of course, had friction with the more senior senators who felt like, well, they've been here 20 years. They don't care that you have TV. So while it can cut against you, the bottom line, you know, have TV coverage or what have you, while it can cut against you, it also can be effective. The second question, more important, is will he be a good policymaker? Will he be studious and serious about the issues facing the country? I don't know. And I really have never been able to spend time around Al Franken or been out there covering any of that race. But it seems to me that the interest and enthusiasm is there, that he is curious. And unlike being a governor or a president, the Senate is just mired in details. And I always found that the senators who got their hands in it and really didn't just rely on briefing books but liked to read, I know that sounds obvious, but you'd be
right.
surprised sometimes, ones who liked to read, who did their own research, who were inquisitive, really got better in the legislative process. And those who sailed a little more on the rough, big messaging level simply weren't there for some of the fights and simply weren't able to get in at the parliamentary and amendment level, which is what a lot of being a good senator is about. So I just think that on the second part, he does have that curiosity, it seems, and the show, his radio show, attested to that as a policy wonk. So I think that bodes well for him. What do you think?
I know we're running thin of time here, but let me say two things. I guess I did a little piece sort of what it's like to be in this sort of limbo land where I talked to Franken and also Norm Coleman, and I was struck by Franken talked about how he actually met with Hillary Clinton's old chief of staff. His goal, at least initially, is going to sort of take the Hillary model, which is something Obama did as well. And that model means that I'm a national celebrity, but I don't want my colleagues to be jealous of me. So I want to spend the first year or two sort of putting my head down, focusing on statewide issues only, not trying to build a national profile, not trying to be on TV
right.
all the time. So that was interesting to me. The second thing is, I talked to him and he said he was very sad that he wasn't, you know, already seated, because this was like right after the stimulus vote. He thought he could make a difference in terms of that stimulus vote, because he would be the 59th senator and therefore they would only need one Republican vote. I think that is wrong-headed thinking, and I'll tell you just briefly why. I don't think that even if there are 59 Democrats, that one Republican is going to vote for the things all the time. I think you're always going to need, these Republicans are not going to, like Arlen Specter and Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe particularly. I think any vote Democrats really want, I think they're going to need, if they want to get one of them, they'll have to get all three of them. So I think you're still in the same kind of scenario where you're going to be beholden, where the most powerful people in the country used to be Sandra Day O'Connor and now are probably these two women from Maine in some ways. I think they're going to have a lot of influence still. And I also think...
But are you saying that he seemed a little out of touch on that point? Like you're saying he didn't seem to have the grasp, or you just think it's a difference of opinion?
No, I think it's... I think it's less about him and more about this. There's this concern, I feel like, in the liberal community, particularly, that, wow, the Republicans are blocking out Franken, because secretly they know that once he gets here, we'll get all this legislation passed, we'll pass card check and all these kind of things. I don't think that's true, as you saw, like, one of the Democrats from Arkansas, Blanche Lincoln, says she's against card check, which makes it easier for unions to form as a big liberal cause. I don't think that things are going to start sailing through once out. I know I'm simplifying the argument some, but...
Well, I will tell you, I'll just say, if the Republicans had 75 votes, they'd still be trying to fight all this stuff. They'd still try to have him not seated. I think if the Republicans had the majority that Reid did, they would have obviously seated someone in a similar situation by now. And we've seen that it's just like Florida 2000. I mean, there's a different level of backbone, and it has very little, I think, to do with the politics of the moment or the numbers count. It has to do with the fighting spirit, which is a lot of what, I mean, again, with the blogosphere and other parts of what you were saying was the left. What a lot of what they're saying is, we sent you out there, go and fight for it, get it done. It's not really a liberal position, it's more of a backbone position.
I don't know the answer to that. I think we'll get another sense of that. It looks like in the district that Gillibrand left, the New York 20th district, that the Democrat is slightly ahead there, and I'll be curious to see how long that legal process lasts, how long that recount lasts, and if Democrats in that instance that they're ahead decide to push it through. Nancy Pelosi's known for being a little more aggressive than Harry Reid is, but these are very dicey situations. You've noticed Obama has not really gotten involved in the Franken situation, which is not surprising either. So I think these are really complicated matters.
Yeah. Well, I think we're about here to our final word. If there's anything else you want to add, I would just close by saying that it also shows a more broken election system, I think, that it takes this long to resolve this, and thus the people of Minnesota are denied representation for this long. There was a good New York Times article about that, and there's been plenty of coverage, obviously, in Minnesota about that. And to broaden it further, you've got several other states where you've had really kooky things happen to anoint and appoint these unelected Senate positions, turn them into incumbents, like New York that you just mentioned. And Senator Feingold has a good legislation proposal that would address this. And without going too wonky, if you look back at the history, it actually turns out that the original idea was not that governors would go filling all these positions, but rather as a very special step, that would be a backup. But there have been amendments and reforms precisely to keep the replacement process in the hands of the people. So it's really a shame that in Delaware and New York and these other places you have that. In Minnesota you have these delays. It really speaks to the need for more comprehensive and more ambitious election reform. So that's one point I'd close on, and I'll turn it over to you for the last word.
Well, Al, there's one more issue I wanted to, briefly I'll bring up on my own, and you can say if you like, too. I find this critique of Vice President Cheney, that we're a little off subject, to be sort of strange. There's a lot of Democrats, I think even David Axelrod, who's sort of, Vice President Cheney's been attacking Obama on the security issues and arguing that Obama is in some ways endangering the country by not, keeping up with the Bush terrorism policies. The critique, though, has not been about what Cheney says, but rather, should Cheney be saying it? He just left the White House soon. How can he be attacking already, and I find that odd. I thought that, we were supposed to disagree. I thought that it's patriotic to, say you disagree with whoever's in charge. I mean, wasn't Al Gore opposing the war in 2002 very, very loudly and very vocally? I find the critique, I feel like a lot of the liberal bloggers complain a lot about, Washington sort of operating by these bizarre rules in which, decorum is more important than policy. Surely the Vice Dick Cheney, if he wants to, should be able to complain, criticize Obama on policy issues if he'd like. I find this a very odd critique. And what do you think, Ari?
Well, okay, so yeah, we'll get on that real quick. I think that the concern, at least in its best form, is that he is abusing his position and that he's making claims that he can't really verify. For example, we're less safe, even though he hasn't had a security briefing since he left government. And thus he's using his pulpit and his position and experience to make claims that he can't substantiate.
I see.
Likewise, a related critique would be that, the presidents generally for a long time refrain from criticizing each other, although I'm not sure that that has to be a bedrock tradition. It has been one. Vice presidents, I guess it's a little more wiggle room. Al Gore example was really, although I guess you could argue this, before I say it, I'm thinking out loud, but Al Gore was largely criticizing a policy and saying we shouldn't invade Iraq. He was not, I don't think, saying at that juncture, this president is bad and is making us less safe this moment.
I think the logical extension of that statement is the next one, but okay.
No, you're right. It probably is. And I think that's the issue, and I think that, Cheney is free to come out and say that he supports torture and that he likes that. I mean, that's fine. That would be a policy position. When he goes further and says right away after a few months Obama's making us less safe, I think there's also the fear that he's betting on another attack, and thus they're laying out putting these chips down on all these comments so that if there is one, that can accrue to their political benefit. That's not a wild accusation given the politics of terror and fear that we had for so many years. So I think that's part of what's built up around it. I, obviously, like any free speech advocate, I would agree with the basic idea that, of course, Cheney can say what he wants like any other American, but I think there are some real legitimate concerns there. So that's where I come down.
Well, all right. Thanks for doing this. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you. And we'll hit stop.